This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. With schools set to reopen soon, the question on the minds of many are, should they really reopen? How can we do it safely? On today's episode in our series called Buka Sekolah Kami, Dr. Kor Swee Keng, an independent health policy specialist, and Professor Dr. Sanjay Rampal, an epidemiologist and public health specialist, join me to tackle those difficult questions on whether schools should reopen and how we can do them safely amidst rising infection and even higher deaths among children. And we're also going to openly discuss the sort of trade-offs we face as a society in deciding on school reopenings. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you today?
I'm well, Juliet. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure to have you both. So yes, you're both also part of this campaign that we're doing, which is called Buka Sekolah Kami. That's, of course, a coalition of teachers, parents, educational institutions, medical professionals such as yourself, and grassroots organizations. We all believe that the cost of school closures greatly outweigh the benefits. So, I mean, some good news, the reopening of schools in stages nationwide will start on the 3rd of October, but that's based on the phase of national recovery plans. Each state is in. Lots of mixed reactions to that, right? How do you both feel about this? SK, would you like to start first?
Of course, Juliet, thank you. Well, in general, I feel and I believe that schools should reopen. So in principle, we cannot let children stay at home anymore because they've had many months really, and soon they might be measured in years of lost schooling. And the short-term benefits of keeping them at home are clear, but the long-term costs will always be unclear. So on a principle level, we should reopen schools as quickly as we can. However, two more thoughts, Juliet. The first one is to say that the way we open schools and the speed that we reopen schools are important. And secondly, at some point, Malaysia will have to have a conversation about, let's call it hybrid education for want of a better term. Because in an era of an endemic COVID, we don't have to make binary choices of schools open or schools closed. And we may be able, or rather we may need, to have a more nuanced option of keeping schools open in a hybrid sort of way. So those are my thoughts about the in-principle decision to open schools.
Okay. And Professor Sanjay, how about you?
Thank you, Juliet, for having me and for the question. I think it's timely, appropriate, and maybe even overdue in the larger scheme of things. So I think it's very important to understand why we closed schools in the first place, right? So if we go back to March of last year, when we initially first closed schools, at that time, we actually didn't know a lot about the disease. There was a lot of fear that the disease would kill off a large proportion of our population. And over time, what we have done is we have learned a lot more about the virus, right? Mm-hmm. And with this additional knowledge, we then went on and opened schools slowly last year. But even this year, the first time we closed schools, I think it was January when we first closed schools. Initially, I thought the reason was for movement restriction because we were still playing along the lines that the strategy of the policies was to restrict movement. And by restricting movement, you could contain the disease. But now we know that we cannot contain the disease anymore. We cannot contain COVID anymore. So we have to mitigate. And that's why I think reopening schools are appropriate and overdue.
Mm-hmm. And, Dr. Sanjay, you're also an epidemiologist and a public health specialist, right? But aside from that, you're also a parent, right? And we've had quite a few conversations about the topics of school reopening. How do you balance the need for your own kids to go back to school versus, the natural worry some parents such as us, have about COVID?
So I think first and foremost, I'm a parent. I'm a father of four kids, right?
Yeah.
So my kids, they range. I have four kids. So they are 18 years old, 16 years old, 13. And the last one is 7 or 8 years old, right? And when we talk about school closures, I always go back to my youngest kid. So she's now in standard 2. She's only been to school like for 1 or 2 months.
Oh gosh.
Ever.
Yeah.
Right. So if you think about this, when we talk about this lost generation of kids, and I remember when we first closed schools, my initial reaction was to go out, buy things for the kids so that they won't feel the mental pressures of staying at home for that initial MCO one. Mm. But over time, we normalized the situation, but I don't think so. The children has normalized it. So they are used to it because we have forced it onto them. But I'm not sure whether they have actually understood why they're there and they have adapted well to the situation. So whenever I go back to the role of a parent and I look at my kids and I go like, schools need to reopen. But then, of course, you wear on your public health specialist hat here and you go, before we open schools, we must understand about the risk, right? And I think we will get to that later. But just to say that I have two, I wear many hats. So at one point I wear the hat of a parent and I go like, school, universal school closures are not good. And the way we have been treating school closures is we've been treating like a blunt sledgehammer trying to break open a nut. So initially it worked, but over time, the cost may be too much for the perceived benefits of closing the schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're definitely going to discuss that a bit more. I guess, you know, the whole thing about schools reopening for in-person learning, and they want to base that based on the phases, right, under the National Recovery Plan. Do you think that's a good idea? You know, SK, would you like to tackle that one first?
Of course, Juliet. Juliet, but before I start talking about the in-person learning as well as the National Recovery Plan, I want to say that I strongly support what Prof. Sanjay has mentioned earlier, that to be unequivocal about this, schools should reopen now. The how and the speed of reopening are always open to question, but in principle, we cannot have universal school closures. And we, in fact, may need to provide some decentralized decision-making to the PIBGs, the school committees, the district education officers, so that they will be able to weigh the risks and the pros and cons of keeping children in school or at home. I think broadly speaking, the time is now, and to use the word from Prof. Sanjay, it's overdue for us to reopen schools. Julie, allow me to try to answer your question right now. And your question is, should the reopening of schools be based on the phases of the National Recovery Plan? I'm going to say yes and no. Yes, it should be based on the NRP or the National Recovery Plan in principle, because the status of schools, open or closed, should be tied to the correct level of public health risk in the community. The risk of public health in the community from COVID will go up or go down. So that's why schools physically reopen or not should really mirror the risk in the community. But no, it should not be tied to the NRP, because the NRP, in my opinion, perhaps has a fundamental, misunderstanding. The NRP is using phases. And it's been stated that once we go into phase two, we'll never go back into phase one. But phases imply time, yeah, when we should really be looking at levels of risk instead of levels of time. Therefore, using phases of phase 1, 2, 3, 4 in NRP is a wrong approach. We need risk level 1, risk level 2, 3, or 4, similar to a traffic light system that other countries are using. So in that traffic light system or levels of risk, if it's a high risk environment for any reason, because cases are high, there's many unlinked community transmissions and so on, then we perhaps need to keep schools closed for a short period of time and reopen when the risk reduces. So I perhaps fundamentally disagree with the, the phased approach to NRP. And instead, I think we should use a level approach to NRP. And that's why my answer is yes and no. Thanks, Juliet. Over to you.
And how do you feel about that, Prof. Sanjay?
I concur. So there were issues actually with the original NRP, right? In my viewpoint, it was overly cautious and likely underestimated the baseline risk of COVID in an endemic setting. And as SK has pointed out, it was non-dynamic in nature, right? So it was linked to community transmission, but the way it was linked to community transmission, I think, could be improved. And even the metrics they used could be improved. However, now I read in the media that their four ministers are working together in refining the NRP. And I think that is a very good move. But when we look at the plans by MOE to reopen schools, I think the reopening is done very slowly and very rigid in its implementation. The idea is that we will always have surge of outbreaks, right? Whether you call it a wave, a surge of epidemic, or however you call it. So we will continue to have waves of cases. Just because in the Greater Klang Valley now we are seeing a decrease does not mean we will not get another increase.
Yeah.
Actually, I foresee in 4 to 6 months, we will get another large increase. So the point is then, how do we mitigate the circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. And I think as SK and I have been saying, that the current NRP is a bit static, right? And may not be reactive enough to the spatial temporal dynamics of transmission.
Okay. All right. I'm speaking today to Dr. Khor Swee Keng, and he's an independent health policy specialist, and Professor Dr. Sanjay Rampal. He's an epidemiologist and a public health specialist. This is part of our Buka Sekolah Kami campaign. We're asking whether schools should reopen and how can they reopen safely. We'll continue that discussion after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today are Professor Dr. Sanjay Rampal. He's an epidemiologist and a public health specialist, and Dr. Khor Swee Keng. He's an independent health policy specialist. They are part of the Buka Sekolah Kami campaign, which is a coalition of teachers, parents, educational institutions, medical professionals, and grassroots organizations who believe that the cost of school closures greatly outweigh the benefits. So, gentlemen, you know, before the break, you were talking about the current plan, which of course is to sort of reopen schools based on the NRP, right? I think let's tackle some more granular sort of fears that are in the community, right? I mean, we've been seeing a lot of attention in the media lately around rising infection, even higher death rates, and this is amongst children, right? And though the number may be small, you know, when you see, oh gosh, it's a child who died, you know, really that just gets people, isn't it? Can we really reopen school in light of those numbers that we are seeing? SK, you want to take it first?
Well, This asks a question that is binary. Can we really reopen schools? Short answer is yes, we can. Perhaps to upgrade that, we should reopen schools. The reason for making these decisions is always about risk calculations, which is a bit difficult to for us to understand because there's an emotional component to the situation. We want our kids to be safe. We want all our children to be safe, and we want them to not have COVID and not suffer any long-term effects from COVID. But that has to be balanced at the same time with an equal importance on their education. I mean, we can't just say we want that all the kids to be safe, but at the full, the cost of them not receiving an education. Mm-hmm. In other words, what we need to do is to find a balance between, well, shall we say, their health and their mental health and their education. And I think these are three very important say points for us to consider. Now, there are some numbers that I've checked that just before I got on this call today. The first one is that it's very unfortunate that we've got about 320,000 cases of COVID in children below the age of 18. As a percentage, this is about 16% of our total caseload, Malaysia's total caseload. However, those aged 18 and below represent 30% of our population. Just taking a big picture number, 30% of the population below 18 contribute 16% of cases. And of the 16% of the cases, the mortality rate is 0.01%. Mm-hmm. It's very unfortunate. And I wish that this 320,000 preventable cases and the 47 deaths that have taken place so far did not happen. Obviously, I wish that. However, when you compare that against the years or months of lost school, months or even years of lost schooling, then the comparison becomes a little bit more difficult to make. And I think we, in principle, will be able to make a very balanced decision on reopening schools. So all that is to say, in principle, yes, we can really reopen schools. There are ways for us to do it safely. There are lessons that we can learn from other countries. And indeed, we must communicate these risks to the population on a more, shall we say, emotionally appropriate way, but also accurate way, so that we're not misled by one or two outlier statistics. Thank you, Julia. Over to you.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Sanjay, you know, maybe you can address some common fears as well. Are children super spreaders? You know, are schools drivers of the pandemic? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
So with regards to super spreaders, I think it has been that what the evidence base shows us is that children are less likely to be super spreaders, and that the transmission is less likely to occur in the schools compared with the houses and the community, right?
Yep.
So with regards to transmission within the schools, I think this is important to note that it's the adults who may be at a higher risk. So that's why it's important for the school teachers, for the support staff, for the canteen workers to be vaccinated, right?
Yeah.
Because they are more likely to introduce infection rather than the students introducing the infection. Mm. It just so happens that what the data shows us is that children are less likely to spread the infection compared with adults. Now, coming back to the deaths, I think I want to address the media's reporting, right?
Sure.
So I think it's very important that we balance the risk and benefits of school closures. So even if you look at WHO and UNICEF statements over time, they've always stated that the schools should remain open and made safer from COVID-19. I think it's just not a matter of opening schools, but also making sure that the schools are safer. Not, you cannot be 100% safe, just safer from COVID-19 transmission. So with that in mind, and also to take into account that statistic of 0.01%, right, of the case fatality rate, mm-hmm. that means 0.01% of children dying from those who get infected. That is actually an overestimate of the infection fatality rate. So the infection fatality rate, because I estimate that our prevalent, our incidence is underestimated by 4 times. So you would get something like 30 deaths per 1 million children being infected. For every 1 million children who get infected, there'll be 30 deaths.
Okay.
That is actually consistent with the US statistics. So US estimates it anywhere between 20 to 50 children dying from 1 million infected children. So as SK had pointed out, that's it's preventable, but it happens. Now, if you compare that with adults, the rates are very, very high in adults. So if you compare with those above 60, for example, the rates can go up above 5% and approach 10% of those who get infected. So the point to note here is when we talk about risk of infection, risk of infection to children, I think, is there. But risk of severe disease to children is very low. And that is something that influences that risk-benefit ratio, the harm-benefit ratio of any intervention. And at the same time, I think we can reduce that risk. So number one, the moment a child leaves the house, there's increased risk, right?
Exactly.
So the safest way for your child is stay at home for the rest of their life. Staying on an island, right? No, actually an island that there may be trees and all. Stay in the house. Even then, you might have unintentional injuries. But the point is, the moment your child leaves the house, they cross a road, there is a risk of road traffic accident. They walk around, they play in the playground, there's a risk of injury. So I think it's important for us to identify the risk. But once we have identified the risk and assessed the risk, we should mitigate the risk, right? And I think we can mitigate the risk by, number one, vaccinating adults around them. One important point to note is we vaccinate the adults around them for their own safety, not for the child's safety. We must remember that sometimes I think it gets mixed up.
Yeah.
We are vaccinating the adults surrounding the children for the adults' well-being, because the adults are at higher risk of severe disease compared with the child.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, I think the schools have to take into account physical distancing and ventilation. And I must say, when MOE presented their plans, when the minister presented, I was actually very happy to note that there will be cohorting. Right, and I think the cohorting by weeks was a good one, because it's much better than what I was thinking before of 3 days on, 3 days off. This is like one full week on and one full week off. So straight away, you reduce the density of schools by half.
Yep.
And I think that goes a long way towards a sustainable, as SK was talking about, sustainable hybrid kind of education, where you can still have essential face-to-face. But the point is, you want to reduce the density of the density of schools, and that's why you are cohorting them, and that's why you're introducing a hybrid form of delivery of education. I think in addition to that, we should also have committees in school, right? We should have COVID-19 prevention committees. And it's important for these committees it's important for us to involve parents. We have not, many of the policies, even the MOE announcement was very top down. Even though there was some engagement done, but I think more can be done, right? And that's why I like the decentralization concept, whereby there's more engagement with the community, there's more engagement with the parents at the grassroots level, then building up a trust, right? You build up trust with the parents that we are here to ensure that your children go to schools in as safe a manner as possible. It's never going to be safe, but as safe a manner as possible.
Mm-hmm. Escape, would you like to add anything to that?
Thank you, Juliet. And I like very much what Prof. Sanjay has mentioned. And maybe allow me to add two points just to extend it.
Sure.
The first one is, risk is around us, and we can never reduce the risk to zero, but we can reduce it to close to zero. I'll give an example of what I'm calling layered risk reduction. With every layer, we're reducing the risk more and more and more. Example is when you drive a car for a So to keep you safe from a traffic accident, there's a speed limit, that's one. Secondly, there are seat belts, there are airbags, there are collision protection bars. We have better roads with better grip, better tires, and better street lighting. All this will keep you safe. in and of themselves, each of them individually cannot keep you 100% safe. But together, as a package, as a jigsaw puzzle that we assemble, we can reduce the risk significantly that people still go out in cars and motorcycles, even though theoretically that's dangerous. So the similar principle can also be applied to schools, where we apply a jigsaw puzzle of solutions or a package of solutions to systematically reduce risk to as close as zero, to zero as possible. So secondly, is the idea that when people are thinking of reopen schools or closed schools, they think of it in binary terms, as in either it's open or it's closed. However, what Prof. Sanjay and I and many others like-minded people are thinking about is reopen schools, yes, but reopen schools, safer schools, and reopen schools more safely. Example, all the examples that Prof. Sanjay has mentioned, split classes, cohorting, better ventilation, hybrid systems. For example, you have online, you shift to online education if the caseload in your community is particularly high. And we definitely need a lot of, shall we say, participation from the parents and a local community as well. At some point, the government of Malaysia will announce an endemic COVID strategy. Part of the endemic COVID strategy will involve something called individual self-risk assessment, as in you assess the level of your own risk. And that assessment of the level of your own risk will probably have to be expanded to community risk assessment, where entire communities decide whether or not they are at risk, and therefore they should open or close, not close, but open schools or go into a hybrid solution temporarily before you reopen schools physically again.
Okay, all right. And I just want to talk about the risk levels for children and COVID again, okay? Because that is obviously one of the biggest concerns for parents, isn't it? And you guys have explained it. Obviously, there's very little you know, risk for the children, actually. But can you give us a sense of how, you know, they compare to other childhood diseases? I mean, like you said, there's no, every time you send your child out, they are going to face some risk. How does it compare to other childhood diseases, COVID, of course? And, you know, what about things like long COVID? You know, is that something that we need to think about for the kids? Prof. Sanjay, you want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. So with regards to risk levels in children, I think a lot of times the news has tended to be more sensational and alarmist in nature. There is a reason for that, because fear has been a very strong emotion during this pandemic, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times the SOPs or the policies may react to fear from the public. But I think what needs to be done is we need to counter this fear with objective evaluation of the evidence, right? Mm-hmm. So when we evaluate the evidence objectively and we see, true, there will be transmission of children, transmission of COVID among children. If you look at the long-term view of COVID, it's most likely that we're all going to get COVID at one point or another, right? Yeah. But what we do know at the moment is that the severity of infection is less among those who are vaccinated, and the severity of infection is less among children.
Mm-hmm.
So, and even children, the risk is different based on the different age groups. So those who are closer to adult, the adolescents who are 16, 17, 18, so those most likely approximate the risk of the young adults. But what is known is the younger children, to put it simply, let's say the children in primary school or early secondary, right? The risk of severe disease is actually much lower. And I've quoted before that the infection fatality rate is only about 20 to 50 million. Now, to put this into context, right? If assume that we have 11 million children, right?
Okay.
Below the age of 18 years, and every one of them gets infected, that actually translates to about 220 to 550 children dying from COVID-19. That's the total number of deaths we will get when all children get infected.
Mm.
As I said, there is this discrepancy between the case fatality ratio or the case fatality rate that's commonly quoted as 0.01%. And this number, because we don't actually ascertain all cases. We are more likely to miss COVID-19 among children because they're more likely to be asymptomatic and more likely to be mild. Now, just to put that 220 of, let's take a maximum number of 550 children dying once all children develop COVID in these many years to come, right? Now, to take that into context, in 2014 alone, there were 562 deaths in children below 15 years. That's in 1 year. Among children below 15 years, there were 562 deaths.
Okay.
Right? And among these 562 deaths in Malaysia, among these young children, 201 was due to transportation. That means just road traffic accident.
Yeah. Okay.
And 192 were pneumonia, and then another 169 due to bloodborne diseases, right?
Okay.
So there is this risk. The risk will not disappear, but the risk will be omnipresent, because to me, I think COVID will be here for the long run. When I say the long run, I mean, I don't see it disappearing.
Yeah.
Neither do I see us, do I see anyone not having it. It's something like dengue, where everybody will get dengue, though the diseases are different, but just where a lot of children will get dengue by the age of 10 or 12, actually.
Okay. So it's something that we will have to live with, is what you're saying, right?
Yes. We have to coexist with the virus in a sustainable manner. And I think sustainability is key, because a lot of policies have been very intensive, very costly for short-term gains.
Mm-hmm.
But here, when we referring back to the endemicity of the disease, we have to look at long-term sustainability, right?
Yeah.
There will be times when risk of community transmission is very high, like what we had in the Klang Valley in the past few months, and what we are having actually in other regions.
Mm-hmm.
So when community transmission is very high, then your health system is overwhelmed. You would want to restrict movement. You would want to reduce the movement. You close schools, I think, to restrict and to reduce movement rather than for safety of children. I think there's more benefit there in reducing restriction, even though, like, for the past few months, we found that even though you reduce or restrict movement, the gains are diminishing, actually, because of pandemic fatigue,
mm-hmm.
right? But if there was one reason to close schools, then it would be to reduce movements.
Okay. And this, of course, is something that we've had in a lot of our conversations about this, right? How the decision to reopen schools should be made by weighing all of the relative risks, right? And not just the risk of illness alone. What are some of the risks of keeping children out of school for a prolonged period of time? SK, would you like to start first?
Of course, Juliet. Juliet, this is maybe I'll add on one point to what Prof. Sanjay has mentioned.
Sure.
That, statistics show that children are more likely to die of choking and unintentional injuries like slipping, falling while playing and so on and so forth than from COVID. So putting that into context, that children are more likely to die from choking than from COVID indicates that maybe COVID will ultimately become a background risk that we accept. It's preventable, yes. We should do a lot against it, yes. But by the same measure, we should also do a lot against children choking, children falling from trees, or children being exposed to traffic accidents and so on. So in other words, this is not a risk that is more than other diseases, and in fact, may be less than other diseases, and at some point will melt into the background. And finally, on that small note, is to say that we can equate almost COVID deaths to terrorist attacks, in the sense that the fear of a terrorist attack causes us to have irrational policy responses and also individual decisions. There is always a risk, of course, of a terrorist attack or a COVID death. However, we should not let it paralyze us and cloud the rest of our judgment and force us to not look at the other costs that COVID is exacting.
Mm-hmm.
And to answer your question, Juliet, these other costs are great. Unfortunately, I don't have data to show you what would be the impact of a year of lost schooling. I don't have the data to show you what is the impact on mental health for our children, for staying at home, not able to go out to play with their friends or just to play or just to be in the playground to run around. I don't have the data to show you what is the impact, the long-term impact of children living, shall we say, in a family where their parents are also staying at home and they're cooped up and with, say, potential for some child abuse or potential for a lot of stress and strife within the family. I don't have any of that data, but it will not be unreasonable to say that these impacts are real today. And it's also very reasonable to say that these impacts are going to be having a very long-term effect on the children as they grow up and account for the 1 year of lost schooling, account for the 1 year that they spent staying at home and not playing with their friends, the mental health component, and also the fact that they may be staying in a high stress environment at home because everybody is stressed at home. It's not just the kids. Juliet, over to you.
Okay. Professor Sanjay, anything you wanted to add to that? Or what are your thoughts on this, actually?
So I think the important thing is just going back to education, right? So education is just not theoretical learning. There's a lot of experiential learning that happens and a lot of social learning that happens in schools. So I think what we have done very well over time, so initially it was not well, but over time is we managed to transition a lot of the material online. But I don't think so children have the capacity to be attached to screens for so long a time. So when we talk about relative risk, about other risk, right? One important point is like screen time. So I remember discussing this prior to the pandemic, and I actually restricted my children's screen time to about 45 minutes or an hour a day.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, the pandemic comes in, and now I have to increase it to 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. Before the pandemic, we were telling our children, do not fixate on the computer. And with the pandemic, what has happened is I've had to buy additional tablets. They're stuck to media all the time, right? So they're stuck either on the tablet, on the computer, doing either classes. And some of these classes are monotonous, but we ask them to sit down and just go through these classes. And in addition to that, they have the homework and everything is screen time, right? Mm-hmm. So this builds on to other risk of online education that we may not have perceived, but we will discover through time. Other than that, I think we should also acknowledge that schools provide an environment for other things like nutrition, for example. So there are many underprivileged children who see schools as an outlet to get better nutrition, right? Compared with staying at home. And many of our less privileged population have actually been very severely affected. And those who, because children are staying at home now in a confined environment, and so my children are a bit more privileged that they have spaces to study, but there are many families in the B40s where the apartments do not allow for these spaces. And then what you have is children who are living and studying very close to each other with a lot of background noise. And there's additional stress to the mother because the mother previously, the children used to go out and she used to have a bit of time there. Now the whole family is there all the time. And in addition to that, for the past few months, you have the father also, right, trying to create his own space, his little kingdom. And
are you speaking from experience here, Prof. Sanjay? Sorry, carry on.
All of this, right, builds on to consequences that we may not have perceived at the point of closing schools.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for some, as you mentioned, you know, the condition at home is not the best, right? Some of them are in unsafe situations at home. And it was school that there was the outlet. It was school and teachers who maybe would have witnessed, you know, signs of abuse or, you know, physical, mental abuse. And they would have been the ones to report them and get them out of that situation. Even that has been taken away from these children at high risk.
Just to add on, that even contact time, right? So when children go out to school, the parents also get relieved.
Yes.
So to say, and that actually reduces the consequence.
Yeah.
Think of it. It provides a mental relief to the parents that the children are in a safe environment. Compare it to when everyone is stuck in an environment, I think that's not so healthy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, what the campaign and what everyone is calling for is, of course, a decentralized decision-making process in this situation. I mean, do you think that we definitely need a much longer-term plan by the Ministry of Education? Is that what we should be calling for, especially now?
Yes, on two levels. Firstly, the decentralization element of pandemic management and even public administration in Malaysia is long overdue because decisions cannot be made by Putrajaya, by a committee of people in the National Recovery Council, National Security Council, and then imposed in a very paternalist and top-down manner to the rest of Malaysia. In other words, Putrajaya does not know best. And in fact, if we're going to live with an endemic COVID, not only does Putrajaya not know best, as in they don't have all the information necessary for them to make decisions, the rhetoric from the government is about community empowerment. And if it's about community empowerment, then empower the community rather than just stick to beautiful buzzwords and the MBA corporate speak. Actually, operationalize a decision to empower the community. The decentralization of decision-making for the, not so much the phases of school reopening, but the opening of schools and so on, can be done in a few levels. Firstly, it could be delegated to state education departments. Secondly, it could be delegated to district education officers. And thirdly, to the Persatuan Ibu Bapa dan Guru, the parent-teacher associations of individual schools. Now, of course, they won't always get it right. They won't. Because not even Putrajaya gets it right all the time. But if you decentralize or if we decentralize to state departments and district offices and the parent teacher associations at the school level were building the capacity and ability for them to slowly get it right. Plus, they will be accountable for the decisions that they're making. Therefore, they're really owning the process and really educating themselves about COVID instead of just relying on Putrajaya to make all sorts of decisions for them. So the decentralized decision-making for schools not only has a public administration component, but also has a community empowerment component. And that is why I'm in firm support of the decentralized decision-making for the reopening of schools.
Mm-hmm. Professor Sanjay, how about you? How do you feel about decentralizing everything?
No, I think I completely concur. Yeah, and I think SK has said it very well. So in view of time, I concur. I agree.
Okay, all right. And, you know, just before I let you guys go, the government, of course, this week has started its national COVID-19 immunization program for adolescents, right? So that's going to involve about 3.2 million individuals. What would you say to teenagers who are feeling anxious about getting vaccinated or those who might fear heading back to school, even if they are vaccinated? Any message to them? Maybe we can start with you, Prof. Sanjay.
So my kid actually got vaccinated.
Oh, wow. Well done.
Yesterday, I think. So what I would say is that there's risk everywhere of COVID. We should understand the risk and we should reduce it as much as possible. So if you're you have a teenager who's going back to school, just make sure that you follow the pillars of prevention, which is wear a face mask in close congested areas, make sure you wash your hands, good respiratory hygiene when you cough, and physical distance as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Do everything we would do when we get into a car, right? All those different pieces of the puzzle, right? SK?
Let's begin with a fact that every year we have about 500,000 babies born to Malaysian women on an annual basis. So the number is about 3.5 million teenagers in Malaysia aged 12 to 17 who will be receiving the vaccine. It was announced today that about 500,000 people are already teenagers have already received the vaccine. So to them, I say congratulations. And what I might say is two things if I'm addressing the teenagers directly. Number one, this vaccine will be one important layer to reduce your risk so that you can go back to school and resume life as normally as you can. So I would encourage you to take it because the benefits far outweigh the risk. And the benefits are not just medical health benefits, but also your educational benefits, mental health benefits, and psychological benefits as well. And secondly, Juliet, if I'm addressing the 12 to 17-year-olds in Malaysia, I look forward to you creating the next vaccine that will save a lot more people.
And just one other thing, you know, for parents who perhaps are afraid of the vaccine themselves and don't want their children to get vaccinated and, you know, are going to send their children back to school, any message to them to maybe change their minds?
Maybe two thoughts to share with the parents. Firstly, to say that I understand your hesitation, given that there are some reports in the news media about how there's some risks, for example, some heart conditions or inflammation of the heart lining that could come out as a result of vaccinations. I deeply understand your concerns. However, the benefits of the vaccination are outweighing the cost. And as you see more and more people vaccinating, young children, say age 12 to 17, not only in Malaysia, people that you know, but also overseas, people that you might know but read about in the news, hopefully you'll have a bit more confidence. The fact that the 500,000 teenagers in Malaysia, and that's 1/6 of the population aged 12 to 17, have already received the vaccine should give you some relief and some confidence that the vaccine is safe and definitely effective.
Professor Sanjay, anything you want to add to that quickly?
So I think the important point is that we have to coexist with COVID for the coming future, and that vaccination actually reduces your risk of severe disease. So whether you like it or not, we're all going to get COVID at some point of time. Vaccination actually will reduce the risk of severe disease. Thank you.
Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Kaw Swee Keng, an independent health policy specialist, and Professor Dr. Sanjay Rampal, an epidemiologist and public health specialist. They joined me as part of our Buka Sekolah Kami campaign. Why should we reopen schools? How can we do it? And why it's absolutely necessary. If you'd like to join in and find out more about the Buka Sekolah Kami campaign, you just need to search for Buka Sekolah Kami on the web. All the information is there. Find out how you can support their campaign as well. And if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Live and Learn interview, you can search for the podcast on the BFM app or at bfm.my/learn. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.